Hello again from Holden Village. This is a taped session by Ted Grosser, and this is going to take place in the Creekside Room. Let's tune in on Ted as he pursues the subject, Much More to Offer the Poor.
Now, what I've been trying to do this week, and in fact last week, is just kind of go through different aspects of how the church relates to the poor, and by and large they'll do a good job. And part of the reason it doesn't, I believe, is because it forgets what its real function is. And we forget that we're really God's people, and that we have some really unique things to bring to the table when we're dealing with the poor. And the other thing I think that we, if I can say, as Lutherans, have some real unique things. For instance, my wife and I have watched over the last about 18 years, something like that, the whole surge of Pentecostalism go through Latin America and catch people up in a whole lot of emotional stuff that brings them up to a high and then just kind of sets them and they drop. And Pentecostals are growing very fast in Latin America, but there's almost as many coming in as are going out. It's kind of a...
Define Pentecostal?
Huh? Pentecostal is one that they speak in tongues. And this
charismatic.
And somehow the Lutheran Church, which ought to have in Latin America the most inside track, because Roman Catholics, by and large, the Roman Catholic Church, by and large, has discredited itself. It has identified with the very rich and the very powerful, and has not kept up. Liberation theology, since the fall of communism, has just taken a beating in Latin America. And their efforts to relate to the poor, to take and stand by them, have really been very discredited. In such a situation, the Lutheran Church ought to be able to zip in with its history of liturgy, its sense of history and everything else. And you know, we're not doing much of anything. We're really not. And part of it is because Latins don't look Norwegian or German or whatever, okay? And we're really stuck in some of the cultural stuff that we just flat need to get out of. And I really believe that the answer to getting out of it is really remembering who we are as God's people and the whole business of grace, the whole business of... I was just flipping through this morning for about an hour and saying, okay, what would I focus on? This is the New Testament, you know? And there is so much where Jesus is calling us into action, calling us to risk all, calling us to trust him and just move forward and be his people. And I don't know. I don't know if that makes any sense to any of you, because I'd like to hear it. I came up with, there were too many things to say. Okay, it's like trying to preach a 15 or 20 minute sermon, and you got 7 hours of material. And as Lincoln said, it's much tougher to speak for 15 minutes than it is for 2 hours. but I sense we don't use what we have as assets. If I were to flip over to Eastern Europe, where we have spent a lot of time and a lot of effort and have lots of involvement right now, I have a good friend who says the problem in Eastern Europe is they have lived under a czar and under totalitarianism so long that they don't have any real initiative, by and large, for most people, and they believe in magic. And they believing in magic, he defines as, if I put my problem out to you, Jody, and you solve it, that's magic. I didn't have to do anything. Okay? And I didn't have to learn anything. I didn't have to invest anything. It just is.
Didn't have to work,
right? And again, Lutherans have a history that does not totally... Sometimes we end up separating the heart from the head, but we try not to, okay? But we're not afraid of using our minds and using our brains. We have a long time commitment to education. And that's the answer. I, my very first parish was in the inner city in Milwaukee. It was Missouri Synod. And thank God we had a school in those days. Because the school saved us. Because, if you will, the kind of people, and I'm not talking about skin now, the color of skin, but the kind of people that are drawn to Lutheranism will be educated people who have ambition, who believe that discipline is an integral part of life. Those people, whether they're white or black or yellow or whatever, come to a school in the inner city that's a good school, like flies to light or whatever. And yet, in those days, we could, after 4 years, we consolidated and tried to do it with a neighboring school. That didn't work, and eventually the school was closed. But it was a real shame. If I had something to say to the powers that be in the inner city, I'd say, man, open schools. And get a whole teaching corps of people coming in and giving a year of their life to making this a really quality school. And starting in first year or preschool, and I would work up over an 8-year period and go for it. Because that's the other thing. With our sense of history, we can in fact take a strategy that says, yeah, it's going to be 8 years before this thing is fully matured. But so what? What is 8 years, you know, in God's overall plan? Because when we look at things, okay, we aren't people running around putting notches in our belt for every person we led to Christ. Okay, we believe in a whole continuum of exposure and seeds planted and experiences, and that somebody is there at that wonderful moment when someone makes a commitment, and then somebody else takes on, okay? And with that kind of a thing, we can bring stability, we can bring just a whole solid sense of building yourself up and your family up as we work with these people. And I think, again, I've been quoting you lots, my good friend over here, because he has the most wonderful, you haven't heard this, I'm going to tell you this, okay? He has this wonderful overlay. He has two overlays, one of which is all of the bad stuff you find in the inner city. And it's with a little bit of editing, you can use it in the third world, where I'm most familiar. It's all the bad stuff. You know, and everything from gangs to tyrants to crime, on and on. And the focal point is that this, or the real point is, this is what has become how we look at the poor of the world, all their problems. And that's how we get grants. That's how, when I look at a direct appeal and I'm looking at a direct mail, how much can I make these people weep over how bad the situation is, okay? And yet, what it does is it's like focusing on all of our sin and never getting over to the new life part. It's never getting over to the promises that we have. But you've solved that for me, and that's great. No, he's got this second wonderful overlay that talks about community and looks at assets. And looks at all the things you can build on. You can't build on this stuff, but you can build on this. And if we can, particularly as Lutherans, again, come out with a doctrine of grace that says, hey, I know who I am. I know all my shortcomings. And I know God loves me, and God accepts me and forgives me. And I can do that to other people. I can take that same approach. And I don't need to be reminded about how bad I am or what I've done. What I need to be reminded is, what has God redeemed? You know, what is now part, and what are the parcel and ingredients of this new life in Christ? And I cannot help but believe that if we do that, wherever we work in the world as Lutherans, and I mean all Christians, but I'm talking particularly, we have a certain tradition, and we get knocked at. I don't know if you heard the guy this morning give the devotion. It was wonderful. Somebody gave his father the book, you know, Norwegian humor and other myths, which I just think is great. They could have done a German one with it. Yeah.
Well, I think we do that to our advantage. It's self-deprecating humor.
Oh, sure. Oh no, I think that's.
We don't take it too seriously.
No, no, and if we can approach ourselves with a certain amount of humor, and we can when we remember that it's God's world. And that what we do here doesn't necessarily have to have all of the ingredients that solve the problem. And part of the problem as Americans, we, you know, I use this example often, but it's true. Regular problems get solved in 30 minutes, bigger problems get an hour special, big problems get 2-hour specials, and huge ones get a 3-day miniseries. And anything that takes more than that, we don't know what to do with anymore. You know, we're watching because we're very close to stuff in Poland, and they elected a communist majority back in government. And what is it, 3-4 years ago, I was traveling with like Walesa, and he was predicting that. We don't do this and this and this, they're going to vote them in, because that's what they know. And yet, if you look at history, when a big empire collapses, it takes almost 100 years before everything settles down and you really have some new forward movement, because you kind of go and then back again. Because people like to go with what they know and what they're most comfortable with. Anyway, that's just really the real basic thing. If I have anything to give or have tried to give this last weekend, or the last 2 weeks, it's saying, look at our basic theology and use it. Too often we're running off saying, you know, oh my goodness, you know, if this church is to grow, if this new ELCA is to grow, we better look at the Baptists or we better look at this or that. And I think we've got enough solid models that if we can get some of the cultural stuff away, we've got a lot to offer. We have. And there are churches that are growing. And that are based on good, sound theology and not just a whole bunch of cheap razzle-dazzle stuff. I was talking to Chuck Lutz last night. We got to talking about Lutheran World Relief and how our philosophies are so very similar, because what we're doing is we're focusing less on relief, and Children's Aid is focusing less on relief and much more on development. And so are they. Our rationale is, with a 25% to 75% ratio, when there is a disaster, it is real easy to invade that 75% and say, well, you know, our development program, which is primarily schools and clinics, they can do without a little while. And then you end up crippling them. And we just aren't that big to do that. And Lutheran World Relief is doing the same thing out of some fundamental basic philosophical views of what should happen. And they will get into relief and development if, in fact, there's very limited capital outlay. You know, and the government wants it going into Mozambique where we've got stuff, and they will use that channel to go into it, or use the Lutheran World Relief channel to go into it. But for us, and I think, I guess I would say that would reflect on both hands, pretty solid Lutheran approach to things, which is, we're here for the long run. And again, education is the way. And all the people running around talking about overpopulation need to hear, really hear, that good health care, education, and economic opportunity will do more good than all birth control pills in the whole wide world. And they really will. And they will have a permanent solution. And again, we have the expertise to do this. I can't think of the guy's name, who was in Indonesia for 20 years. They're just leaving now. Lemp, is it?
Yeah, it was.
Anyway, here's this German who has spent all of his life teaching Hebrew in Indonesia. It's wonderful, okay? And we were talking, and I said, well, where are you going to be going? This was last night or night before, because they're getting ready to go. He says, oh, I don't know, the bishop's invited me back, and my health is still good, and I still love to teach. And so he's probably going to go back. And it's great, you know. But I think we're also going back to, and even in our parish ministry, out of the thing we had in the 60s and early 70s, which is if you're 5 years, you've done everything you can possibly do, and move on. And I think we've learned that that's not a very bright way of doing things. That, you know, just like marriage needs to be for the long haul, so you both get to know each's strengths and weaknesses and build on that. And so I think we really have that to offer. One of the areas that I put down here that Lutherans don't do too well in is risking. And there's a certain part of serving the poor, and serving even the unchurched too, is there is this risk factor that you cannot get away from. And I think, again, I think our traditions help us. Okay, and the tradition of saying, even at a point of, if you will, conversion, that there's a long history to it and there's a long history after. That with that kind of a continuum, we can really believe, I mean, we can act upon the belief that this is God's world, and that if we really trust the process, I've spent several sessions on the integrity of the process, in knowing, on the one hand, what you believe to be God's will, and then doing it, and not having to know what the outcome's going to be for certain. Because you can't. And again, we've talked about this in some of the other classes. I don't know about your life, but mine has not turned out the way I thought it would, by a long shot. You know, and I think that happens in programs overseas. Again, one of the most vivid ones was we went to Guatemala because Janet and I have a long history there, and we were going to start a school because we know how to start schools. And everybody said, "Don't do it. We got more of those than we need." And so right now we're working with a preschool that takes the kids of the working poor who work 14 and 18 hours a day, drop their kids off, and if they didn't have a place to drop off, they leave them and pull a child out of school to watch it. And now they're getting two meals a day, they get medical care, they're getting, as they grow older, it's kind of a Spanish, Head Start program. But it doesn't always turn out the way you want it to turn out. But it's not always bad that it turns out that way. You know. The other thing that I got as I was flipping through here is, and I just wrote, why are we so afraid to defy custom? Jesus is defying customs all the time. And challenging us to do that. And one of the places, and again, we're just now, 3-4 years into working in South Central Los Angeles in this project, so I'm not certain I can draw any lessons from it like I can from the third world. But in the third world, what you get are people running around saying, my goodness, you don't want to change these traditions of these people. And the people want the traditions changed. The people do not want their children to die. They don't want them to be uneducated. And again, if you think that people live in isolation in any part of the world, you're wrong. Holden is a total freak place, okay? Because you can go into the most remote places, yeah?
When we were in northern Thailand, among the refugee camps.
Yeah.
In that little bitty dinky little town, sleeping literally on wood frames and had, you know, cloth over it. Walking down the street to find a place to eat, and here in this little store is one of these Japanese
high-resolution
televisions.
See that sucker a block away, you know. But that is really common. To think that there are people in this world who do not know how we live in the United States is wrong. We are, in fact, the country that is setting the pace for better or for worse. And you can take whatever you want out of it, okay? But in fact, even in Red China today, the kids are dressing like Americans. they know what we do, they know our music, you know, and again, not all of that's something we're proud of to be claiming, but it's there, and that's what's happening. And to think that there's some way we can avoid this whole wave of I don't want to call it progress, but whatever, Americanization or Westernization, it is happening. And I could just tell you all kinds of stories about why it is great to travel as an American. You know, even better than the Japanese, who have more money when they travel, and who have, by the way, taken the place of ugly Americans because they're the ones with all the cameras now. But people want to go and speak English. If you talk to the Petersons in Taiwan, and she's saying, well, yeah, I work with all these Philippine women, but I don't speak very much Philippine because they all want to practice their English. And all the years, Janet's totally fluent in Spanish. I'm not, after all those years, because ministers of health want to practice their English. And I can go to Eastern Europe, or to Africa, or to Asia, and this is the language of the world right now. I'm not certain we know how to be people who are citizens, if you will, of the modern Rome, because we're very uncomfortable with that, but that's where we're at, and we need to probably have to look at that. But the whole business of risk is one that I think is so important to think we need to really look at the thing. The other things I just want to mention, again, is looking for the good, look for the positive, and we, that just comes out of the gospel. That one of the things I found in here is I just love to remember that the first miracle was turning wine or water into wine at a wedding. You know, who would expect to find the Messiah at a wedding, kicking up his heels and putting his blessing on the thing? And so we need to be, I think, looking at all the, what we would call the common, ordinary stuff in life and finding God at work in there and getting in tune with it. Listening, I always have listening as a big thing because I have seen so many programs blown away because people don't listen. Yesterday I got off on one of my favorite hobby horses, which is the big science, Christ is the answer. What's the question? Listen long enough to find out what the question is, or it doesn't make much sense to me. The whole business of respecting, and part of respect to me is not only just honoring a person for what they are, but also being able to honestly look at the situation and say, this is not good. And not just running around the bush, but just being able to, man, this flat isn't good. And there are places, for instance, we don't have the problem of massive wholesale child labor law violations. Let me tell you, all over the world, it's there. I mentioned a couple times, I once sat in a meeting that talked about what is the proper age to sell a girl into prostitution in Thailand. Not whether the selling was bad, but what's the age. You think slavery is dead in the world, you're wrong. You're wrong. It's big time, big business in places. And those are things I think we need to confront as wrong. If there are customs that don't permit or encourage, for instance, children to get immunized, I think we have to call those wrong. And I think we have to. One of my fears is that we're going to have that problem in these United States pretty quick. As you've got people who are, you know, avant-garde, whatever, saying they don't need shots, and these people over here really too ignorant to really know the value. And if we're not careful, those two are going to get together, and they're going to create a critical mass that is going to be awful. Okay? Because you get resurgence of some of these childhood diseases that we don't really know. In the United States, and it's terrible. It's been a number of years since I've been in Colombia, but it is so vivid to me that I went into a hospital that had more children under 10 with crippling polio than we had total cases in all the United States. That was just the first of a bunch of hospitals I visited. Polio is not wiped out. But for instance, in Eastern Europe, where they warehoused, under the Soviet system, they warehoused all handicapped children, all retarded children. And they warehoused children that we wouldn't even consider handicapped, really. Cleft palates that can be fixed up very easily. Okay? But we've got pictures of them, lots of them. The fact is there's another place where a well-trained church like the Lutheran Church can send people in and make a tremendous amount of difference. Okay? All our Germanic history of organization, holy fright, can that be used in parts of the world? We can send people in. And I have sat in on meetings in Eastern Europe where they're saying, yeah, it'd be nice to have all of your money, okay? But that's not going to happen. Send us your expertise. Send us people who know how to manage. Send us people who are independent enough to start a project and stay with it. Don't send it. We just know how to go here, so, so. Okay? Because everything was, in fact, divided up and chopped up to keep everybody off base. You know, and only a couple of people at the top really could bring all this stuff together. Most people down here couldn't. But again, we have things to offer that I think are strong things and real good stuff. I love the whole idea in the gospel lesson for a couple of weeks ago was the story of going off over the, going from the Jewish side to the, the non-Jewish side, the Gentile side. I'm just learning the language, so be patient. But the storm for me kind of symbolizes the kind of the upset, kind of the messiness, and the uncertainty and the risk that you have going from where we are to where we need to go. And again, almost expecting Jesus to be this magician, you know, and he gets up and says, you know, what's the matter with you guys? Don't you trust, you know, don't you know what this is? And then getting over there and then doing great things. Oh, welcome to my class, Elizabeth. Okay. One of the things that struck me as I paced through is a number of places Jesus is saying, you love your children or you love those close to you, big deal. Everybody does that. Love your enemies. I've got another friend who says that particular charge is the most revolutionary charge of their statement of Jesus Christ in the world. Love your enemies. Because it really, in that day and time, turned everything upside down. Okay. I'm going to just stop and anybody got questions or comments?
I think you're right on. I think that that whole area of risk is really true. I don't know what the answer is.
I think the answer is we got to take leaps of faith, and we need to encourage the church to do that.
Even if it's encouraged. I mean, you know, we've had some. You know them and I know them. They're gifted pastors. Encourage risk in their congregations. Sometimes with some success.
But see, that's where I think if we focus on the process and not whether it's a failure or a success, because that's a whole other area, the whole fear of failure. And I can sit here and I can tell you that I have had some very big time personal great things, I really believe.
Yes, no doubt about that.
You know, but I don't think we teach that enough. We're really trying to say, how can you lead the good life and avoid all this stuff? And the truth is, there isn't any way. You know. And again, I like to talk about my accident all the time, but you know, I'm going to go off to preach or teach to speak to church women. They weren't Lutherans, that's probably why it happened. This semi truck driver changes lanes, and 2 years out of my life, that fast. Which for me was the wonderful outcome of that, to realize that I don't really have control over anything. You know, that really it's God who has the control, because there wasn't really any good explanation for why I didn't get killed in that whole thing. You know, I didn't. And have been able to really sense the privilege of being part of God's plan in the world. But I do think the whole thing of risk is probably the whole key.
It's a major part of it.
You know, it seems to me, as I think about people who I guess you've got a little distance from, you could say have taken some big risks and done some pretty amazing stuff, that a lot of it seems to me to be the reason people do that often is because they've gotten into relationships with somebody who's a little different from them. And it's the personal relationship that sort of drags them, us, into another dimension of the world, right? Remember, there's this wonderful gentleman in the village now who's a farmer from Wisconsin. I don't know if you've run into him, I forget what his name is. But he talked, he made a speech at his Synod convention 2 weeks ago, which he was telling us about, which was the speech which turned around the resolution, which was going all the way through the Synod convention, condemning gay and lesbian people, essentially. It was a really sort of bitter. And the reason he did that was because just this last year, somebody in his little Wisconsin community who was a 50-year-old man, had come to him and his wife and said, you're the only person in this community that I can talk to, that I feel like I can talk to and tell you it's driving me nuts that I'm gay, and I've been gay in this community the whole 50 years of my life, and now I need to say something to somebody about it. So he said something to this guy, and this guy just sort of turned around, and all of a sudden has become, I'm sure totally to his own surprise, nature spokesperson in this Wisconsin Synod for gay and lesbian people, and sort of turned around his whole Synod. And it just, you know, when I think of suburban congregations that begin to get into relationship with inner city stuff, it's often because they meet somebody. And it's a personal kind of thing that stretches.
So that's what we're trying to do in Los Angeles, is trying to work out, and right now we're focusing on the stuff downtown, in South Central. But eventually, to bring in people who have various kinds of expertise in suburban congregations to come down and help. I don't think you can just sit people down and say, be friends.
Right.
You know, because it doesn't work,
right.
Okay? But if they're doing something, it's a consequence together. And then, when the next riot happens, because I don't believe our society is going to respond quick enough to heal some of those wounds, when the next one comes, at least not everybody will be terrified of the people on the other side.
Yeah.
And that's part of what happened. I mean, and now they're building new freeways on a harbor freeway. You can even pass the slums even higher in the air than ever before. You know, and you just don't have to see it. But if you do see it, it does make a difference. We had a totally different experience, because I'm divorced, remarried, so on. And in 1979, we were in Rome, the guest of the Jesuits, and we were standing back at the Gregorian. And the Pope proclaimed, he was new and throwing his weight around or whatever, that he wasn't going to laicize any more priests, okay? Take a vow, that's the end of that. And we've been at the Gregorian long enough that these young Jesuit students from all over the world liked us. And they were battling back and forth. Well, I thought my position was the guy ought to be a little bit more open and a little bit more merciful and so on. No. You took a vow and you didn't break that vow. And I said, but I did. They say, well, that's different. He said, no, it's not. But in point of fact, if you know somebody, it's much harder to be so judgmental. Okay? If I haven't, I gotta tell you this little quick side story. The Jesuit guest bureau was run at that time, and still is, by a very tall, very strong Italian woman named Elena. And they were all debating the Pope's proclamation and so on. And he said, "What do you think, Elena?" And she said, "I think the Holy Father missed a wonderful opportunity for silence." And so at our house for now some years, he said, "Yes, it's an opportunity for silence."
That's a great line. Sorry.
Many episodes. Many good.
You know, the other thing I liked that among many things I liked that you said, Ted, was that you think about the links between the Lutheran heritage, the gospel centrality of grace and education. And it made me think about some of the incredibly clever and inventive things that Bishop Gomez has done in Salvador.
Mm-hmm. Right?
Where basically any of us from North America who think we know what a university is, right? And think we know what a campus looks like and what it sort of ought to be, St. Olaf or something. But he basically just declared whatever was there a university. He said, okay, now let's figure out how learning happens and how development happens and who can come here and teach what to whom else, right? And pretty soon all kinds of things happen simply by declaring what was already there, a university. And I don't know if there's a pastor in Tacoma named Ronald Mathis, who saw that in Salvador, came back to the housing development that he was working at, public housing in Tacoma, did the same thing. He now has Sal Shan University in Tacoma. And he just sort of declared it that and then started seeing what would happen. And it's a wonderful idea, it seems to me. It's full of grace, right? And it begins to sort of set an agenda for what it is people ought to be doing with each other. And all kinds of things are happening because it happens.
See, what I think, and I've had a number of people after sessions come up this past 2 weeks and say, "You mean there really are some things I can do?"
Yeah.
Because I don't think we as a church have empowered our people enough to say, you're a teacher, or you're a school counselor, or you're an electrician or a carpenter. One of my dreams in South Central Los Angeles is to get a whole bunch of union tradesmen together, take a couple of houses, and remodel them and show kids, particularly gang members who are very highly organized, how to do this. And say, okay, let's do another one. The third one, you're in business on your own. And let them go. All these houses that are down there that need to be rehabilitated. And suddenly you could create, from within, a whole kind of fishes and loaves thing. Because there is more money to do some of this stuff than you think. Okay, but we don't do that. In our synod, after the riots, we had this wonderful whole Saturday thing. And nobody did anything. They just threw out ideas and nothing was organized. And what, over 600 people came and over 600 people went home saying, gee, maybe we ought to do something someday. And I talked to guys like Pastor Al Starr, who was one of the key people in this five parish or new city parish thing. He's frustrated because all the talent is out there that could end up transforming this place and being a witness for a predominantly white church in this predominantly black area. To be a witness of something more than people who whiz by on the freeway and are afraid of you. I mean, I don't care who you are, a little kid of whatever color that climbs up on your lap, you know, and starts playing with you or wants to be read to or anything else, melts a whole lot of stuff away. And you don't have to have a PhD to read it, a story to a child. And we're starting to receive some of that in San Diego. We're doing a grandparenting thing with Latino kids who need to learn English or they're just going to be gardeners all their life or maids. I don't think we really put it out there in a way. We say we believe in the priesthood of all believers, but don't get too priestly. you know, don't get too priestly so that you really take Luther seriously when he says, you know, a good bricklayer is better than a bad priest. Hmm? But he's right. He sure is right. And again, to go back to this, you can't always tell the outcome, but if you are really in keeping with God's will in the process of reaching out to really make people, because you can't just go in and say, you know, I'm going to save your soul. You've got to be offering them, you know, the whole concept that comes out of the Old Testament of wholeness. We're working with the whole person. And give that person training. Give them some encouragement. And lots of it doesn't take a lot. We were talking the other day about the Penny Foundation in Guatemala and the whole revolving loan thing that took off at a grassroots level in Bangladesh and in other places. For relatively little money, you can set someone up in a business, even in a slum in the United States. And the experience is 100, well, in Guatemala it was 99% collections and the 1% was accounted for by debt. Everybody got a loan to pay it back.
Same as Chicago.
Mm-hmm. And I think that there are things, it doesn't take all that much. We can get over, we can just get our minds blown, and I can too. Yeah, 40,000 kids a day die, you know, from hunger and hunger-related something. What can I do with that? I'm sorting through in my head, what am I going to do? We're going to go, in less than 6 weeks, we're going to be in Africa looking at 25,000 kids orphaned by AIDS. How to get your hands on that, man? And some of it's fairly brutal, very, very difficult. Because as I'm thinking and literally praying my way through this, you get to sort out those that have AIDS and say, somebody else has to help those. We can't. I mean, for children's aid, we can't do that. We can't even help those that are HIV positive. Okay? What we need to do is try to get these guys off and give them the nutrition and the training and whatever they need, and that's what we're going to focus on. At this point, I don't have any idea what that number is going to be. I don't have any. But I know that that's what we got to do, and that I have to be true to that process, or we're going to end up overextended, or we're going to end up just making a mess of things. And getting the word back here that, you know, AIDS really in Africa and Eastern Europe is not a homosexual thing. It is totally heterosexual. And look out. Because the predictions for Africa are awful. 25 years, as many as from 65 to 75% of the population could be infected in a nuts way to oblivion, making the Black Plague look like the picture. And they're really, I mean, parts of it in the Ukraine and Romania and so on, they're terrified. But it's because their sailors and other folks come up contaminated and so on. There's an area where I said, you mentioned before, you got to look at customs and say these are wrong, okay? It's a custom throughout much of Africa to send the 13-year-old boys to the city from the remote villages where they have their first sexual experiences with prostitutes who are infected with AIDS and who come back. That's not so easy to just get up and say that's wrong, because they're saying, well, look at my uncle and my grandfather and my father, and they're all alive. And how do you say, well, listen, guys, it's a different world. You know, and you aren't going to be anybody's uncle if you don't, you know, spurn yourself away. And I think we need to be involved in some of that and just say, well, no, we have to accept their customs. Their customs are going to wipe them out. Any other thoughts or comments?
Another question. You've obviously thought a lot about how the United States interacts with the third world, and your striking analogy was with the Roman Empire.
Mm-hmm.
Clearly, that's one set of ways to interact with one's dependence. how hopeful are you that the U.S. could figure out a way that was non-imperial, or at least
not really,
different?
I think we'll last a long time. And there are certain things that are happening in the world that make it real different, much different than, for instance, at the time of Rome. I mean, it's a much smaller world. The issue in the future is not going to be, is the Soviet Union going to rule, or is the United States going to rule? We're going to work together. I think that part of it's gone. I think they may bounce back and forth with philosophical communists, okay? They're not going to be economic communists. They know that doesn't work, okay? And they are as afraid of the world being blown up by a Gaddafi who gets his hands on some nuclear warheads as we are. And if we're not, we ought to be, because that's where the danger lies. You know, or the Israelis and the Arabs get into something when they nuke each other. You know, and say, oh, it's just going to be in the Middle East. No. So I think that's part of the issue. But I think, for instance, we need to look, as I've thought about, for instance, the Soviet Union, we do not have an economic model, really, to offer the former Soviet Union. Sweden does. With a kind of a mix of capitalism and socialism, they are not going to go. If you read anything, you know that almost one-third of the people who immigrated to the United States and got out by one way or another in the 15 years prior to the fall of the Soviet Union, a third of those went back. And you want to know why they went back? They had never had to worry about a job before, they had never had to worry about housing before, and they never had to worry about health care. And they said, man, HEB can listen into my phone calls, so I don't have to worry about those three things, it's okay. They are not going to adopt an American model of capitalism in any wholesale way. There's certainly going to be capitalism. There is in a place like Sweden. You know, and in some modification, all the Scandinavian countries pretty much have that. And to a lesser degree than other parts of Western Europe, that's an economic model that's viable for them. Ours is not. Okay? If you want a model for how we ought to be funding what's funded under AID or aid, foreign aid, go to Canada. CETA's got it has a system of great integrity. What are the needs of the people? How do they identify those needs? And can we afford to invest enough to make a difference? That's the way the decision's made. Okay? The United States is still 8 out of every $10 really has to come back to U.S. vendors, and none of it goes out to anybody who is not politically in tune with the United States. And that's the government's right, and I don't quarrel with that, okay? And we don't take any government funding, because in point of fact, there needs to be another channel and another voice to these people that say, listen, Americans as individuals, okay, can be God's people. And God's people reach out, and we don't care what your politics are. Okay, and I think we can. I think in my mind, one of the changes that's going to be taking place in the future is we're going to be more open to that, because a different political system, with the demise of communism as a major force, is not threatening. We know how to get along with dictators, and over the last 25 years, I've been working in this stuff. I've worked almost in more countries where there have been dictators than where there have been democracies. With the blessing of our government, with the help of the State Department and so on, we know how to do that and not be threatened, okay? And I think that will continue. And we're not at odds with Gaddafi because of his politics particularly. It's because of his support of terrorism and some of these other things. So the other thing I think is the older I get, the more I want to be spared from, in quotes, true believers. And the fanatics will kill you in the name of God because you disagree. That, to me, is the danger in the world today. And they can be fundamentalist Christians, and they can be fundamentalist Muslims, or they can be fundamentalist Buddhists or Hindus. And in my mind, they all believe that because they have this great revelation, nothing should bar them from cramming their point of view down your throat, even at the end of a sword. And that's what I think is the frightening thing. And again, some real challenges and to the church. And I think if we really look at the whole doctrine of the visible and invisible church, we may find that the Lutheran Church is very, very uniquely equipped to reach out, to be an ecumenical force in the world, and not just in the Christian world. I don't want to get off on that. That's another couple weeks. Anybody else, any other comments or questions that I can go on and on with? Thank you very much.
Do you know the South Shore Bank? Do you know the South Shore Bank? You know that story at all?
No.
It's a little bank on the south side of Chicago, which has invented a way of banking that they call community development banking. Oh. And it was started by church money, foundation money. And they moved into a neighborhood that was on its way down, changed racially, was going to mold the way all racial change neighborhoods. And they said one of the reasons the neighborhoods do this is because their banks leave. Right? So they bought the bank. And what they've done is to stabilize the neighborhood. The neighborhood is now a mixed income, stable, healthy neighborhood. This is 20 years later. The reason I'm telling the story is because then, in the last 5 years, first Poland, then Croatia, and then last year Russia, came to the United States looking for banking and investment models to take back. Wow. As they were shifting their economy, and they started at Citibank, and they went to Bank of America, and they visited all the top 10 banks. And what they found was that no bankers in the United States knew how to grow an economy.
Right.
They had absolutely no idea how to develop an economy. And they ended up at South Shore Bank. And so South Shore Bank is now the major economic advisor to Poland, Croatia, and Russia, right? It's just it's an incredible story. So there's, you know, there's sort of the kind of dialogue between the developing world, where there's second world, and inner city stuff in the U.S., I think it's just fascinating. You're in a wonderful spot.
And I think as we've talked, that it's a kind of a two-way street.
Absolutely.
There's lots of stuff that goes both ways.
Well, see, and South Shore was the one that imported the Grameen Bank from Bangladesh.
From Bangladesh,
into the U.S.
That's great.
Started that stuff.
Let's try to have a visit before I take off tomorrow.
You go,
okay. Okay, thank you.
Yeah, there's
okay, great.
They have Tita, and they have the main branch of Guatemala City and the other branch in Huehuetenango, which is the northern part of the country. And the way they had no phone communication up there, and the way they got the information was over shortwave radio.
Sure. Okay.
Here's the deposits.
Yes.
Which are all
yes.
Sure, the antenna was working.
Absolutely.